It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In December, Australia became the first country in the world to implement a social media ban for children under 16, requiring major platforms to do extensive age verification.
Now, Republicans in the state legislature have put forward a slate of bills to regulate how teens can interact with social media, with penalties for tech companies that don't comply.
The proposed legislation aims to restrict what shows up in a teen's social media feed, with other bills aimed at tackling how children interact with AI chatbots and requiring better warning labels for explicit content.
In just a bit, we'll hear from a researcher at UW-Eau Claire about what we know about social media and youth mental health. First, we're joined by a sponsor of a bill on social media for young people. Representative David Steffen is a Republican representing the 4th District, which covers the area just north of Green Bay in the State Assembly. Representative Steffen, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
What is the problem that you and your co-sponsors see out there that you're trying to solve with this AB 963?
Yeah. Well, since 2012, which is the year in which the majority of people switched to smartphones and the advent of social media, we have witnessed an unprecedented level of anxiety, self-harm, and depression, especially among girls, but teens in general. And what the source has clearly been identified and really has been unrefuted is social media. Kids are spending on average over 5 hours a day on social media. And that is causing long-term damage socially, mentally, psychologically to our youth. And so we're looking to address it. Last session, I was the lead author on this legislation. And this year, I'm supporting the other legislators as a part of making this happen. And we have a very good shot this year of getting this across the goal line.
One question here is, how do you know if it's a teen user? Some places have gone with age verification, saying, hey, you got to provide ID to prove you're over a certain age. That's not, as I understand your bill, not what's happening here. What are you requiring from social media companies, the big ones, in this legislation?
Yeah, it's a great point. And that was a sticking point last session. So it is now adjusted to what's called age estimation or age assurance. So the companies that offer this service have now added features and the ability to analyze the activity, the keystrokes, the sites, the interaction that's occurring, and very quickly estimate the age within, you know, it has a 95% accuracy of determining the age of the individual that is engaging in the social media. And what that does is it allows individuals to be verified through the electronics, through the software, versus a parent having to add an actual ID or a user using an ID to the platform and thereby creating yet more information that these companies have on us.
Okay, so a teen is on Facebook. Well, I guess that's not that likely. A teen's on TikTok, say, and the platform says, hey, this looks like a teen. Then once that determination is made, what would this bill require them to change for that user?
Yeah, if the system identifies them as likely being a teen, then at that point they are required to provide age identification. And if they don't, well, then the system shuts down on them. So it is pretty clear in terms of the way this will work. But in general, the goal is to, the best way possible, without jeopardizing privacy, providing an opportunity for teens to still have a positive experience, but not one that has doom scrolling, not one that has addictive AI-driven advertising, things of that nature, as well as providing protections against predatory action by pedophiles. So we're trying to put these protections into law because, to be quite frank, parents need help. Schools need help. Grandparents need help with all this. So we're putting these in place. They're reasonable. They're certainly achievable by the industry. And this is a first step. This won't be the last thing we deal with, social media and its negative impacts on children. But it's a major step forward for the kids and parents of Wisconsin.
One general argument against state-level restrictions like this is these are platforms that are nationwide, worldwide, and it's going to be really complicated and, from a business perspective, really difficult if they have to comply with different regulations in every state in the country. What do you say to that concern?
Yeah, that is the primary argument of big tech, And so while they don't want it at the state level, guess what? They don't want it at the federal level either. So they are fighting and have successfully blocked similar legislation at the federal level. I'm not going to wait for my Congress to protect children in Wisconsin or my district. And so by putting these in place in Wisconsin, we're at least ensuring that we're doing what we can here in Wisconsin. Additionally, it puts pressure on our federal legislators to get this done at the federal level. The argument becomes stronger for a single federal policy that overlaps and supersedes Wisconsin, which I would be fine with. But until and if that happens, we still have thousands of kids that are being negatively impacted to a point of self-harm, suicide attempts, anxiety and depression. And so until and if that happens, Wisconsin needs to have something in place.
Representative Steffen, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's David Steffen, Republican State Assembly representative from northeastern Wisconsin. We're talking about a new bill he put forward to create stricter rules on how teens use social media. Now we turn to a researcher for a look at what we know about the effects of social media on adolescent mental health, what it would look like to regulate big tech companies at the state level. Justin Patchen is a professor in the Department of Political Science and Criminal Justice at UW-Eau Claire and co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. Justin, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Glad to be back.
A huge topic here, the impact of mental health on adolescents, a big part of the reason for this legislative push, as we just heard. Broad strokes, what do we know from the research?
Well, there's no doubt that anxiety and depression have gotten worse among youth over the last decade or so. I think there is some doubt about the cause of that, and it's probably true that technology contributes. I don't know that it's the sole cause. I think there are other social and family issues going on, but no doubt there are ways that technology can be modified in a way to make it safer for youth online. I don't know if this particular legislation is the solution, but it's certainly worth exploring.
Looking at some of the targets of the legislation, Representative mentioned the addictive features, the infinite scroll, right? As a grown-up, sometimes I wish that would stop. Do you think that's something that would be of benefit to teens, whether it's happening in state law or the platforms do it voluntarily?
Well, you're not wrong. I mean, I think we all could benefit from that. And if you've spent any time on some of these platforms, you can see efforts that they're taking to even reduce that. I know if I spend a lot of time on TikTok, let's say, eventually some nice lady pops up and says, maybe you should take a break because it's been, you know, an hour that you've been scrolling. So I think there are measures being taken. The question is what measures are effective. I'm a researcher, so I would like to, you know, work with these companies to identify the strategies that work. Of course, these companies want more eyeballs on their content or the content created by others. So it's sort of a, you know, a double-edged sword in terms of balancing how much time people are spending on the platform and not creating issues with their mental health.
For that research, I know a big concern is how much do social media companies open the back end for researchers to, you know, get in and look at what they're doing? TikTok, I think, notably doesn't share a lot of information with researchers. What kind of access would researchers like you need to really make informed judgments about how these things function?
Well, of course, as a researcher, I'd love as much access as possible. TikTok does provide some opportunities. They provide an API that allows some researchers to access some data. We did a project for them a few years ago looking at harassment in comments on TikTok. And so I think they do cooperate, and all the companies do cooperate with some researchers, but it needs to be, there needs to be more of that, of course, and it needs to be more transparent. Because, you know, we're all in the same boat. We want, just like the representative said, we want everybody to have positive experiences online. And I think these companies want to encourage that as well.
If legislators at the state or federal level came to you and said, hey, you've been working on this stuff for years, Justin, what kind of law changes could really benefit teens based on what we know through these years of research?
Well, I think we need, I'm not sure, there's a lot of little things, and the laws that would help solve these problems would provide more resources for communities, specifically parents, teachers, and teens themselves, to get educated about the tools on these apps to make their experiences safer. Because many of these platforms do have tools to block, report, to limit the negative experiences, but a lot of parents simply don't know about them. So I think education is more important than sort of a law, but we certainly need to hold these companies accountable if they are engaged in predatory practices that target our kids. And so identifying that through research and curtailing that is certainly a solution we're all looking for.
I think I heard from Representative Stephan and some of his colleagues supporting this, a sense of frustration that parents have to do a lot. This is overwhelming. This is a constantly changing social media landscape. New platforms come on. Platforms change what they do. Do we put too much responsibility on the parents and not enough on the platforms to protect teens from the negative impacts of some social media use?
No, there's no doubt it's hard to be a parent these days. I've got a 16-year-old at home, and so I'm living and breathing these issues to see nothing of the research that I've done, you know, among thousands and thousands of teens across the U.S. It's a complicated issue. Just one quick point related to this. My research partner and I did a study this year, actually last year, early 2025, and surveyed 3,500 youth across the U.S. And about 32% of those said using these chatbots and these apps actually improved their mental health and improved their real life relationships, whereas only about 5 to 8% said they worsened. And so I think there's a lot more going on here in terms of the potential positives for these tools. And we can't lose sight of that.
Very briefly, Justin, AI is coming on board, lots of changes on the horizon. What are you watching for next?
Well, I'm continuing to track the way that young people are using technology via AI or whatever the next great thing is to harm each other. But I also, because, you know, my main focus is cyberbullying,
right,
and some of the social networking problems. But I also am very optimistic about the ways in which these tools, particularly maybe even AI, can be used to mitigate some of these problems. And the age verification that the representative was talking about is one clear example of that.
Justin, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's Justin Patchen, professor in the Department of Political Science and Criminal Justice at UW-Eau Claire, co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. We also heard from Republican Assembly Representative David Stephan, been talking about new efforts in the Wisconsin legislature to impose stricter regulations on how minors can interact with social media.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the U.S. Supreme Court banned race-conscious college admissions in 2023. We look at Wisconsin admissions and check out new research on the impact on schools.
We saw these declines in underrepresented students of color, but we also saw increases at a lot of other institutions.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down affirmative action in 2023, Wisconsin's four-year public universities have seen an increase in Black and Hispanic student enrollment.
That trend has been less pronounced at UW-Madison compared to most of the other universities of Wisconsin schools.
A new analysis from a nonprofit called Class Action found that more selective universities have seen lower Black and Latino enrollments after the court banned race considerations in college admissions.
And that has led more of those minority students to enroll in public universities that are less selective, like most of those in the UW system.
We're digging now into the enrollment data at Wisconsin colleges to see how admissions demographics have changed since that Supreme Court decision.
James Murphy is a senior fellow at Class Action, which works to promote equity in education, and conducted this new analysis. James, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Your new research looks at how the end of affirmative action affected college enrollment all over the country. And one takeaway, you see declines in Black and Latino admissions at highly selective universities. What did you learn, and where did these freshmen go instead?
Well, what we learned is that essentially, college admissions is a very complex space, is actually, I think, the biggest lesson from looking at all this data. So in some ways, what happened with the first year, and it's only 1 year of enrollment after the Supreme Court decision, is that we saw something we expected, which was you'd see a decline in the enrollment numbers for Black and Hispanic students. That did happen, although not uniformly. What I think wasn't appreciated when the decision came out was that even though most colleges never considered race in their admissions policies, about, you know, somewhere between 200-300 of them did, many people thought that the decision would only affect those colleges. But that isn't what happened. It affected those colleges for sure. We saw these declines in underrepresented students of color, but we also saw increases at a lot of other institutions, right? So a reminder that college admissions is a complex ecosystem. It's not just what happens at one institution.
Like University of Mississippi, a 50% increase in Black freshman enrollment. How did that happen?
Yeah, so this is the part that was intellectually expected, right? There's been research on what's called a cascade effect in enrollment. Most of it, or sort of the maybe the best of it, coming out of an analysis of what happened in the University of California system after they banned affirmative action with Prop 209. And the idea here is essentially a super qualified, really strong student who happens to be Black had a better chance of getting into UC Berkeley before Prop 209. Mm-hmm. After Prop 209, that their chances would have dropped, right? They would have lost that advantage. They're still super qualified students. So it's not like, all right, I didn't get into Berkeley, so I'm not going to college at all. They're probably going to be more likely to enroll at a place like a UC Irvine or UC Santa Barbara. So they're sort of cascading down this sort of selectivity of kind of rankings of colleges. Therefore, when they show up there, some students who may have gotten into those places would then cascade down to kind of the next tier of selectivity and so on and so on. So this is why, this is how you can see there's going to be this big ripple effect, mm-hmm. right? So as I say, we'd seen it in California. There'd been good research modeling this. So in a sense, it was intellectually totally expected. Still, in the reality, when I saw the numbers in places like University of Mississippi or the Citadel was another place, Louisiana State University, these large increases in Black and Hispanic enrollment, it was still surprising to me. Is it simply because of a cascade effect? No. There are probably things going on at different institutions that would explain the impact, right? The University of Michigan enrolled more Black students in 2024 than it had since 2001, right? So that's even before they banned affirmative action in Michigan. Michigan would probably tell you, well, that's because we increased our financial aid and we did a better job of recruiting students. And I'll bet that's true. But if you see this large effect, 80% of state flagships saw an increase in the enrollment of underrepresented students of color, we have to look at something wider than just individual policies. And I think the cascade effect is the most likely explanation for that.
But then what are the consequences of fewer highly qualified students of color enrolling at more selective colleges like Ivy League schools because they're still going to good, say, flagship universities?
Yes, that's a great question. It's an important to recognize both the good and the bad of this. I don't want to find a silver lining to the Students for Fair Admissions decision to say, like, oh, actually, no, it all worked out and everything was good in the end. I don't think that's true. I think the decision was a bad decision. But the sort of the negative impact of having fewer students of color at elite institutions, I think there are two. One is the impact on those students, right, who would have had a better chance of getting in. Who are now no longer attending the colleges and universities that, for better and for worse, mostly for worse, tend to send a disproportionate number of students to medical school, to law school, to incredibly high-paying jobs. So the impact on them is real. And the impact on the students who are in those campuses is also real and negative. I believe, just like Supreme Court, the Chief Justice John Roberts believes, that diversity is a benefit on a college campus, right? Being in the 21st century around people with different both political ideas, mindsets, experiences, backgrounds is actually, you know, it's an amazing opportunity. We don't get it enough in life, and college is a place where that can actually happen. So those campuses are less rich now because they're less diverse. But the flip side is this is a bias of where I live in Boston. Essentially, Harvard's loss of Hispanic students is probably Boston College's gain. So the impact of these students sort of cascading to less selective state flagships and other less selective institutions, well, it's good for those institutions. I think it's good news that the University of Alabama is more diverse after the Students for Fair Admissions decision.
James Murphy with us, senior fellow at the nonprofit education organization Class Action, as we talk about demographic changes in college enrollment with this analysis of 2024 federal enrollment figures released last month covering thousands of colleges and universities. Do you know, James, why this trend seems to be more pronounced for Black and Brown students than other minority groups like, say, Asian American students?
Yeah, the simplest explanation is that there wouldn't have been any real advantage given to Asian American students at most selective institutions. So that has a lot to do with simply the math of all of this. For lots of complicated reasons we could get into in great depth in a whole nother program, The number of students who have the academic qualifications and non-academic qualifications in some case to apply seriously to a place like a Harvard, a Yale, a Northwestern, a University of Chicago is much, much smaller. Mm-hmm. There are many fewer of those students than there are white students with qualifications and Asian American students with those qualifications. So those students weren't receiving that kind of tip before, is what that's the sort of the language in enrollment offices or admissions offices. They refer to these tips, and there's many of them. Athletic recruiting, being a good athlete is a tip. Being a legacy at a lot of colleges, that's a tip. Being from Montana and applying to a college in the Northeast is a tip because they want students from every state. So Asian American students were likely not, and there's variations here, but were likely not getting that kind of tip at most of these highly selective institutions.
Okay, and this leads to, as you say, tip, leads to other things here. I mean, do you think this change over the last few years is all attributed to the Supreme Court decision that ended affirmative action, or are there are many other additional factors going on here that might influence these numbers, like the admission staff and cost and where you live and legacy and things like that?
Yeah, every single year of college admissions is the weirdest, most complicated year when you talk to people working admissions, right? They're like, oh my gosh, this year's crazy. That's every single year, right? So at the best of times, it's complicated, right? This is, again, like I use the description that it's a complex ecosystem purposely, because in a complex ecosystem, what one place does is not the whole story, right? And that's why the Trump administration targeting schools for prosecution or taking funding away from them is such a bad idea, because what's happening even at a Princeton and a Harvard is not solely a case of what is happening at Princeton and Harvard. These colleges are all affecting each other. But yes, the enrollment data here is impacted by the usual so many other things going on, preferences for legacies, preferences for athletes, preferences for students who go to very expensive private schools. There's geographical elements as well. We also had, of course, COVID and the lingering effects of COVID that complicated everything in education. There was problems with the FAFSA form 2 years ago, which would have impacted this enrollment possibly, although College Board has really good research showing that maybe not so much as we thought it would. So we have 1 year of data, and we have to be very careful, what we want to say about it. I mean, the point, I guess, what I'd sum it up is we barely know what happened after Students for Fair Admissions. It's going to take a long time to figure out why, and, that's where we need, smart academic researchers looking at that data in a much more detailed, slower, more methodical way than organizations like I do, which where, we really want to get people answers as quickly as possible, but own up that, we don't have all the answers.
And you sure could use some 2025 figures as well if you want to crystal ball this.
I sure would. And colleges were really, really slow to release those numbers this year. So it's going to be another year, and I'll be back at it again. And we'll talk then, I hope, about what those 2025 numbers look like.
Well, James, thank you so much for your analysis and context. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That is James Murphy, a senior fellow at Class Action, a nonprofit that works to promote equity in education. He was with us to share its new analysis of college admissions demographics since the U.S. Supreme Court banned race-conscious college admissions in a 2023 ruling. Now we're looking closer at what Wisconsin universities are experiencing in their enrollment of minority groups. Taylor Odell is an assistant professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison, where he researches education policy on college access and success. Taylor, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate. So excited to be back.
As you've watched enrollment change in the last few years without affirmative action, what has stood out to you about what you're noticing here in Wisconsin and in schools here?
So I think when you just had your conversation with James, researchers and students and parents and admissions officers are really thinking hard about what these decisions mean for institutions in terms of the information they have to make decisions about who to accept in their entering classes. But it's also affecting individual students and parents, right, and their calculus about where to apply and how to apply and what their odds of admission look like. I think institutions are also thinking about how do they grapple with this new policy environment and making the best decisions that they can to ensure that they have not only robust and diverse classes, but also that they're using all points of data available to them to help craft those incoming cohorts of students.
I want to get your take on this cascade effect that the researchers are also seeing. Do you think Wisconsin's relative lack of highly selective universities is helping these schools benefit from the downstream consequences of the Supreme Court decision?
Yeah, so I think your question is a very good one and points to one important fact, which is UW-Madison is the most selective institution in Wisconsin. And so as you just heard James say, when we talk about affirmative action, we are really only focused on the nation's most highly selective institutions, right? Those with single and low double-digit admissions rates. When we talk about like the Ivy Plus, we're talking about 4% and 5% of applicants being admitted compared to UW-Madison, where we're talking around, you know, 42-45% of applicants being admitted. And so what that necessarily means is that affirmative action, particularly in the way that we're talking about today, wasn't widespread in Wisconsin and hasn't been even before the SFFA decision. And so that necessarily means that the impacts of that Supreme Court decision are going to be a little muted in our state, which is what I think the report from Class Action also very clearly shows.
And of course, this year, UW-Madison creating a new office for first-generation students and students with financial need as it dissolved its division that's focused on diversity and equity. Do you see things that Wisconsin colleges and universities are doing to attract more students of color in recent years, besides this cascade effect that's showing up in the numbers?
Yes, I think UW-Madison and colleges across Wisconsin are thinking about ways of attracting a variety of students, right? Not only racially or ethnically minoritized students, focused on socioeconomically disadvantaged students, which is evidenced by the expansion of the Wisconsin Promise Program for students who are from low-income families, also focused on the recruitment of rural students and native students and a variety of others. And I think what you're seeing in the development of these new offices is not only a focus on the recruitment of these students, but a very real investment on part of institutions to invest in the retention of those students. So not just getting them in the door, but making sure that they walk across that stage at the end of their 4 or 5 years and that they secure a high-paying job as well.
This data from Class Action showing UW-Madison was the only four-year UW school that saw its percentage of white enrollment increase from 2023 to 2024. All other schools saw declines or were flat. Why might that be different for UW-Madison?
So I think it's what you're seeing here, and it is a function of that cascading effect that James and Class Action are pointing at. It's also important to note that those same national trends are happening here in Wisconsin. So Madison, as the selective state flagship, did see that decline in Black and Hispanic students, whereas other campuses like Milwaukee saw an increase in those populations. And so I think this means like a couple of things, right? It means that we are still trying to recruit the most academically qualified and diverse class of students. It also just means that institutions across the state, regardless of whether or not they are a selective campus or not, are simply able to leverage fewer pieces of information in that decision-making process. It might mean that some students from inside the state are going elsewhere to other selective state flagships like Michigan or Minnesota or Illinois, or it might mean that they're also thinking about enrolling at private institutions, whether in Wisconsin or other selectives nearby, like a Northwestern or the University of Chicago. But as James said, also, these are questions that are really hot in all of our minds right now, but it's going to take a couple of more years of data for us to really understand not only how this affected the most recent class of students, but how it's changing enrollment trends generally.
Taylor, as you continue to monitor these numbers that come out, these trends in Wisconsin college admissions, what will you be watching for in the coming months and the coming years?
So as James maybe alluded to, and what I'm really focused on is not only students getting access to college, but also students completing college, so earning that degree and then making a successful transition into the workforce. And so when we talk about cascading across colleges, mm-hmm. right, from highly selective to minimally selective to less selective, we also have to think about what this cascade effect means for outcomes. So this necessarily means there are going to be fewer Black and Hispanic students trained at highly selective institutions, which means fewer students transitioning to premier or elite medical schools or law schools, et cetera. But it also means that many of those students who are now attending these state flagships are pushing out other students, right? Which is another way of thinking about cascading, mm-hmm. Taking up some of those seats. And so that's also going to have downstream effects for students who aren't affected by affirmative action in any way, right? There's going to be fewer seats on many of our college campuses, which might mean fewer people being trained to meet the state's growing workforce demand. And so I'm going to be really focused on completion rates, I think, for these students across a variety of demographic contexts, but also how the visual profile and socioeconomic profile of our new workforce emerges.
Taylor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kate.
Taylor Odell is Assistant Professor of Educational Policy Studies at UW-Madison. He talked about what he's seen from Wisconsin universities and the diversity of students admitted in the years since the Supreme Court struck down affirmative action. Earlier, we heard from James Murphy from the nonprofit Class Action, sharing a new report on college enrollment trends.
Coming up, Chippewa Valley Technical College has the only competitive cheer team in the state's technical college system. The team captain and coach explain the sport and what students get out of it.
It's really all about the journey and the connections that the athletes build and everything they learn throughout the season.
That's next here on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Mary Kate McCoy brings us a story about popular game show host Alan Ludden's Wisconsin roots.
Many know TV personality Alan Ludden for his days as the host of the popular game show Password, or for his marriage to the beloved actress Betty White. Perhaps lesser known is Ludden's Wisconsin roots. Writer Dean Robbins recently stumbled upon his Wisconsin connection during a weekend getaway to Mineral Point.
I recently visited Mineral Point to sample its famous attractions, including the historic mining sites and the 19th century architecture. But during my stay in southwestern Wisconsin, I also stumbled onto a bit of local lore I'd known nothing about. I overheard several conversations about Alan Ludden, the smooth-talking TV game show host of the 1960s and 70s.
Now, here's your host on Password, Alan Ludden.
Well, thank you. Welcome to a special edition of...
And at the Red Rooster Cafe, the small town's popular breakfast spot, my placemat listed Ludden's grave as a Mineral Point highlight. Many tourists might have said, and continued visiting the art galleries on High Street, but not me. I grew up with Ludden's Password, in which contestants traded clues to guess a mystery word. As an elementary school bookworm, I was drawn to a game show host who glorified the English language. We even wore identical horn-rimmed glasses, which made him look dashingly brainy and made me look like the last one you'd pick for dodgeball. While my friends watched cowboy shows, I kept the dial tuned to Password and, no surprise, grew up to be a writer rather than a ranch hand. I'd never thought about it before, but some of the credit goes to Alan Ludden. After a hearty breakfast at the Red Rooster, I searched the internet to explore Ludden's Mineral Point connection. He was born there in 1917, and his father, an ice dealer, soon died of the Spanish flu. When Alan was 5, his mother married the guy who ran Mineral Point's electrical plant, after which the family moved around Wisconsin. Alan graduated Phi Beta Kappa from the University of Texas and then earned a master's in English, suggesting that his intellectual image was not just an act. After receiving a Bronze Star in World War II, Ludden hosted radio and television shows and found his star vehicle at Password in 1961. That's also where he met fellow TV personality Betty White.
Why, Betty White.
Why, Alan Ludden.
Well, it's nice to see you again.
Nice to see you.
What are your plans for the summer, Miss White?
Oh, dear. I'm.
They fell deeply in love, married, and worked together on stage and screen until Alan's death from cancer in 1981. White never remarried, saying, "Once you've had the best, who needs the rest?" Ludden was laid to rest in Mineral Point, and townsfolk speculated that his beloved Betty might be buried beside him. To their dismay, she chose not to join him for eternity in Wisconsin, though she did donate his papers to the Mineral Point Library before her own death in 2021. My Alan Ludden journey ended with a pilgrimage to his gravesite on the western edge of town. To its credit, Graceland Cemetery gives no special treatment to Mineral Point's famous son. So, in the absence of signage, I wandered for a while through the sloping grounds. Finally, I found the tombstone, which mentions Alan's service in World War II, but nothing of his showbiz career. Indeed, the peaceful plot feels as far from his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame as you can imagine, bordered by the Iowa County Fairgrounds and rolling farmers' fields. I couldn't help thinking that Betty White might have been quite comfortable there.
Children's author and journalist Dean Robbins brought you that story about the popular game show host Alan Ludden's Wisconsin roots. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
This is WPR News.
Chippewa Valley Technical College in northwestern Wisconsin doesn't have a traditional athletic department, but in the last few years, the college, with roughly 18,000 students, gained an esports program, intramural football, and, for the first time, a competitive cheer team.
With 11 athletes, the River Otters are the only technical college competitive cheer team in the state. Late last year, they had their first cheer competition.
Competitive cheer has gained popularity in recent years with TV series like Cheer, a Netflix docuseries following a team in Texas.
Now we meet the River Otters coach and the team captain. Macy Bump is cheer coach for the Chippewa Valley Technical College River Otters cheer team, and Izzy Kading is the cheer captain and the flyer. Izzy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Macy, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Macy, what made you want to bring competitive cheer to Chippewa Valley?
Yeah, I mean, we have competitive cheer in the Chippewa Valley already in different avenues, but I really felt like CVTC would thrive with having this type of a program there. I, like I said, coached high school cheer for about 6 or 7 years prior to this. And I actually did help with the college cheer previously at a different college for a few years as well. So I knew a lot of the students at the technical college, and I thought that this would be a great opportunity for them.
also reflecting on my time when I was a student there, wishing that I had this opportunity. So I just felt it was the right year to give it a try. And now here we are.
And what is that opportunity, Macy, for the students? You don't have a full-on athletic department or the football team or things like that. So what are you hoping to provide for people who join the team?
Yeah, it's still an athletic outlet for them to learn new skills, to work really hard, and to go and compete against other colleges. Learning like athletic skills, like I said, and getting stronger, but also being a part of a team, a really close-knit team, developing relationships. Those are really the most fun parts of the journey. But competitions is also what we look forward to, competing against other colleges and other cheer teams, putting together the routine, traveling, awards, all of those things. Those things are fun, and that's kind of what we look forward to with the season, and that's our motivation in the season. But what's it's really all about is the journey and the connections that the athletes build and everything they learn throughout the season.
Izzy, you're on the team. You're the captain of the team. What has this opportunity meant for you as part of your college experience?
Honestly, after high school, I did not expect to cheer ever again. So it was kind of, okay, you got a few years on a cheer team and then you're going to move on from it. And with Macy starting the program at CVTC and kind of getting things running, it was just a perfect opportunity to do something that I loved again at a collegiate level, which was super cool.
Macy, people might hear cheer and think of, you know, the people on the sidelines during the football or basketball game. This isn't that. This is competitive cheer. What's the difference for people who don't know?
Yeah, competitive cheer is a team that the community can support rather than on the sideline, it's cheer supporting a different team. So competitive cheer, it's now kind of turning the table a little bit. Other people can cheer for the cheerleaders. They are putting together a structured routine that is scored and judged at competitions, and it abides by a rubric, and it can be very intense and very competitive versus when you're on the sideline, you're kind of doing it for fun. You're cheerleading a crowd of people that's for a different sports team, and it's more so free-spirited, and you're doing the typical cheers and chants. But when you're looking at the competitive side of it, that is when you're doing a structured routine that's filled with stunts, tumbling, jumps, dance, and not really those cheers and chants you'd see on the sideline.
Izzy, this is a team and people fill different roles. I understand you are the flyer from that name. I can kind of guess what that would look like, but what does that mean to be the flyer on the competitive cheer team?
Yeah, so being a flyer means you're going up in the pyramids. You'll have bases underneath you. So I go up in baskets. So that would be a basket toss where they throw you in the air. You do a trick or something in the air and then get caught again. So it means being basically held by the other cheerleaders and being on top of them.
And there's a lot of trust there, I imagine. What is the training? What is the process to be like, hey, you're going up and you know your teammates are catching you on the way down?
Yeah, so it actually starts a lot with just building those friendships and building those connections within your teammates. Because we walk in and most of us are strangers. I think walking in there, I only knew one or two people and not super well. So you got to walk in, you got to build those connections first. You got to make those friendships before you're ready, I feel, to go and be thrown and caught by them. Because it is a lot of trust that you need.
We're talking about the Chippewa Valley Technical College River Otters cheer team, the school's first competitive cheer team, state's only cheer team associated with a technical college. We've got Macy Bump, the coach, Izzy Kading, team captain. Macy, what goes into planning out, choreographing, I guess, a performance for the team?
Yeah, it's really about looking at each individualized athlete and what strengths they can bring to the routine and what weaknesses come into the routine. It's not a routine that you can easily trade people in and out. It really is unique to every single athlete that's on the team. What goes into that is really looking at the score sheet and what the athletes that you have, what they can accomplish on the score sheet, and then making it all flow as seamless as possible.
And Izzy, as one of the athletes, is there some back and forth where you get the choreography, you work on it, you offer some ideas back to the coach?
There are definitely times where we'll give suggestions, but with the coach's process, they look at the skills that we can do. They look at all of our strengths. Like Macy was saying, she looks at each individual athlete. So usually their plan is exactly what's meant for us to be doing. There's definitely some things where I'll be like, I think we should do this or I think we should do that. And it's put into consideration, but at the end, it's ultimately the coach's decision.
Macy, you mentioned the scoring, and this is something where you perform competitively with other squads and get a score. What kind of factors go into that score?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The factors that go into the scoring process would be the type of stunts that you're doing. So you can do some basic stunts or you can do some elite level stunts. And obviously the elite level stunts are going to be harder, so therefore they're worth more points. Kind of similar to that is pyramids. You have to show pyramids and you could do some basic level pyramids or you could do elite level pyramids. And the more elite things that you do, the more you get scored. And then tumbling is kind of similar. The more you have, the more you're going to score. And then there's kind of an overall effect on the score sheet is, was your routine seamless? Did it flow well? Did you use a lot of the floor? It's kind of just the overall effect of the routine score. So it can be pretty black and white, and a coach should be able to figure out what they're going to score before they go to the competition.
Now, there is some cheer out there in popular culture. There's an American Sweethearts show about the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders. That's, you know, the sideline cheering. And then a Netflix docuseries called Cheer about a competitive cheer team in Texas, a technical college also. Izzy, have you watched these shows? Do you feel like any of them are getting it right and presenting that experience?
I have watched a few of them. I think the main one that actually would show the full experience would be the cheer documentary on Netflix following the Navarro cheer team. They do a really good job of showing the highs and the lows and just the reality of cheer practices, showing like everything that goes into it, going to build the routine and eventually like going to competitions and things like that as well. And they do that in a way that I don't think a lot of the other shows do.
Macy, are you getting a lot of interest from students in participating in the competitive cheer team or just, you know, support from students and the community when you're out there performing?
Yeah, we did have our first performance in December and we had a huge turnout for that. A lot of community support, a lot of parent support. So that was amazing to see. And yes, we have had interest from students. We had a more than expected turnout for this year for tryouts. And then I have had people reaching out already that are telling me they want to come try out for next year. So the future is looking bright for the support for the program.
Izzy, I imagine you are spreading the word both at Chippewa Valley Technical College and elsewhere. What do you say to encourage people to give cheer a try if it isn't on their radar?
Yeah, I definitely am spreading the word about it. A lot of people haven't heard yet that CBTC has a cheer team, so that's pretty cool. And I tell them about the team. I tell them about the friendships I've made, the trust in the community that we've made. And when you talk about cheer, you can't not talk about having a good time. So,
and Macy, for anybody at a technical college thinking of starting a new program, a new athletic program, whether it's competitive cheer or something else, what would you say from your experience to encourage them to get it started?
Yeah, I would say just at least start with asking. I had no idea if this was going to get approved or not. And I just emailed one day, like I looked up in the staff directory for who I thought I should reach out to about this just to ask if it was possible. And then we met and talked about it further. So I would say for anyone who wanted to start something like this, that you should come with a plan. You don't want to come into it without a plan. And I had a really good plan with how the program was going to be sustainable and how it was going to work and all the details. And I think that was really helpful in getting things started.
We'll leave it there. Macy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And Izzy, thanks for being with us.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Macy Bump is cheer coach for the Chippewa Valley Technical College River Otters cheer team. And Izzy Kading is the cheer captain and the flyer. This is the first competitive cheer team at Chippewa Valley Technical College. It's time for the Olympics. Today marks the opening ceremony in Italy, and some events are already in action leading up to the event.
And there is a strong contingent of Wisconsinites and UW athletes in the Winter Games. They're representing the U.S. and Wisconsin in sports, including biathlon, luge, Nordic combined, skeleton, and speed skating.
And women's ice hockey. Lots of women's ice hockey.
Don't forget the women's ice hockey! Yes, and we've had lots of coverage of Wisconsin Olympians here on Wisconsin Today and on the Larry Mueller Show and in our news reporting.
You can check out stories about a number of those athletes, including Kate's interview with biathlete Deidre Irwin and a big feature on women's hockey players with Wisconsin ties online at WPR.org.
And let us know which Winter Olympic sport you are following. Email us at WisconsinToday@WPR.org, or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson and Lauren Cox.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Tim Peterson is our managing producer.
And Dean Kinetter is our executive producer.
Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.